Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest? Oh, I see. They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons & Dragons.
Hello and welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. My name is Sergio. Unfortunately, this week we will not be joined by Lore Mistress Mary. They are busy at home, getting everything situated and done up right, so that we can start doing other cool stuff, like perhaps streaming on Twitch. But they're taking the week off. We're still covering the Nine Hells. However, we're not going to take a break. Can't stop, won't stop. We're lore fanatics, so we're going to continue this. We're going to be talking about Maledomini this week, the seventh layer of Bator, the seventh layer of hell. This place is pretty gnarly. It's not as gross as previous layers. Malbolge, I'm definitely looking in your direction. But there is a lot of cool lore attached to it, especially when it comes to the ruler of the lair, the archdevil who runs the show. So let's just go ahead and just jump right into it. The watchword in Maledomini is decay, in both its physical and moral connotations. If ever Maledomini was beautiful, that time was long, long ago. Now it is a scarred landscape of ruined cities, clogged canals, and lifeless tree stumps. The endless strip mines that dot Maledomini look like gaping wounds. All right, so the seventh layer, as we said before, of the nine layers of Bator, it is ruled by Balzabul, also known as the Lord of Lies, also known as the Lord of the Flies, also known as the Fallen One, or more specifically, Triel the Fallen. And we will get to that when we discuss Balzabul after the middle of the show. So, a great marble boulevard lined with grotesque statues known as the Road of Perdition leads from Malbolge, which is the sixth layer of Bator, to Maledomini. An endless field of ruined and crumbling cities dot the decaying, pitted expanses of the lair. Under the blood-black sky, petitioners query, carve, and build new cities for the Lord of the Seventh. Mine pits, slag heaps, and brackish canals cover the land like sores. Newer cities are built upon the backs of older ruins, and as each city is finished, the Lord's dissatisfaction forces his subjects to begin anew. So very Sisyphean in that respect. You know, all these lower minion devils are forced to build and create and carve and dig and do all that stuff to make a city. But for whatever reason, Beelzebul says, I don't like it. And they have to tear all that down and start over again. So a lot like, you know, pushing the boulder up the rock only to have it roll down each and every day. Sludge-choked rivers wend their way past the endless strip mines, and sentient chunks of polluted matter crawl up onto the riverbanks, only to gasp and die upon inhaling the toxic air. That's wild. So these sentient things make their way out of these sludge-choked rivers, and then only to end up breathing the air in Maledomini and dying because it's pretty much poison. Dying forests collapse, succumb to rot, or burst spontaneously into damp, smoldering flame. And it is said that the lair constantly shudders and moans like a wounded beast clinging hopelessly to life, all the while weeping a foul black ichor. That's pretty evocative and like pretty much the flavor text that I love. It's no surprise that a lot of this lore comes from, you know, advanced D&D when the literary content was, in my opinion, at an all-time high for D&D. The lair also contains dozens of vast tunnels that meet and diverge in a maze stretching for hundreds of miles. Maledomini being one of the largest of the nine hells, its branching passages link all the lower hells together. In various spots, its tunnels reach Malbolge, Cania, and even Nessus. So layers 1 through 6 are all, you know, all connected, or at least, you know, are linked to Maledomini through these tunnels. The tunnels, they average about 3 to 5 miles wide, with ceilings of 1,000 feet or more overhead, and each is a long, curving cavern featuring ancient strongholds, the aforementioned crumbling cities, and ruined palaces that climb the tunnel steep side. So, it's kind of like, you know, any sort of like post-apocalyptic idea where, you know, the old city is destroyed and a new city is built on top of it, but the remnants of the old city are still there. You know, they're the clues are still there. The what's left behind is still there. Guttering green flames seep along the riverbanks, and drifting balls of luminous green fire provide a dim, sickly illumination for the lair. But some of these tunnels, they lack this natural lighting, and so they brood eternally in foul, cloying darkness. In addition to being such a lovely locale, it is also the center for all the bureaucracy of the Nine Hells. So all the red tape, all the lawyery part of Hell is where it's centered here, which makes it, I feel, probably the worst layer, to be honest. And it once was a beautiful and fully urbanized realm. But as a result of Beelzebul's treachery, and we'll get to more on that again after the middle of the show, the lair is now the devastated wasteland that we know and love today. So like I said before, once a city is complete or near complete, Beelzebul judges it unworthy. And then construction begins anew. Previous cities are plundered for raw materials, which pretty much only hastens, you know, their ruination. These old cities have become the homes of runaways and deserters and creatures from other planes. And occasionally, Beelzebul will send units of his army through these old cities, through these ruined cities to, you know, to roust out these malcontents, which it just causes them to flee to a different ruined city. And thanks to Balzabul, like, they have almost countless to choose from. However, the bravest of these malcontents flee to the tunnels beneath the cities rather than escaping to a new city. Some say that the original denizens of Baltazul still live under the cities, under the streets of the old cities. We're not sure about that. We're not sure if it's the old original devils living there. All that's known for sure is that something is living down there, and it isn't friendly. Which, that being said, if Mary were here, she'd probably say, like, oh, whatever it is, I want to boop it. I just want to boop that little thing, whatever it is. I'm sure it's cuddly. Like, Mary's gonna boop something that shan't be booped. It's gonna be her end. I stand on that. So Maladomini. Let's talk about some of its more notable locations. We've got the Carnival Eternal, also known as the Carnival Macabre. Under an unblockable sluice pipe that eternally showers filth down into a mucky veil, devils caper and cavort in a nonstop bacchanal known as the Carnival Eternal or the Carnival Macabre. Balzabul rewards his successful minions by allowing them to spend time engaging in unspeakable, diabolical pleasures here. A devil that brings the Lord of Lies 9 souls gets to stay for one day. If the devil brings 99 souls, a haul of 99 souls earns them a century of time within the carnival. And finally, 999 souls are worth 2 millennia of ghastly entertainment. Among the bizarre attractions in the carnival is a hall of distorted mirrors, which, if you wipe the layer of sludge that's, you know, stuck to the front of one, the viewer can gaze upon an intoxicating vision of themselves as the archdevil ruling a layer of Bator, you know, like Dis or Cania, but never Maladomini. Never see yourself ruling Maladomini. No. Also, the carnival is home to a thriving black market in which devils barter for things forbidden even in the 9 hells. Things like stolen souls, treasures hidden from the lords of the 9 hells themselves, writs of safe passage, and books of banned rituals. We've also got Grenpoli, the city of diplomacy. The city of Grenpoli, aka the city of guile, is a haven for pure politics. Access is granted only through one of the 4 gates on the city's exterior, and entrance to the city only comes after a thorough search, during which all weapons are taken for the duration of a visitor's stay. It's a dome city. Where, like I said, weapons of all and all types of aggression are forbidden. It contains the political school of the 9 hells, which offers courses on deceit, courses on treachery to the, you know, to very, you know, enterprising devils. Much like the city of Dis on the 2nd layer or Tantlin on the 5th, Grenpoli is a place where commerce and intrigue come together. It lies on a broad and easily navigable portion of the Styx, the River Styx, and trade bound from the middle hells to the lower hells often passes through its dilapidated storehouses. It at first appears to be the most civilized city in hell. You know, the fact that, you know, you can't carry weapons in it, you know, you can't cast offensive spells, there's no violence, physical violence, I should say. So Grimpoli's, it functions as a training ground for devils in the fine art of the deal. Every edict, policy statement, scientific treatise, and other document in the 9 hells is recorded, copied, and filed away in Maladomini's archives. The storehouses are buried deep underground so that they would remain intact if the lair is ever again hit by the sort of devastation that occurred after Balzabul's treachery and when he was, you know, subsequently humbled. Each document in the archives is important in its own way. And all these sites are heavily guarded by devils, obviously by devil guards and by traps. Even if would-be thieves could get around the defenses, they would then have to figure out how to navigate the complex classification system that marks the precise location of each bit of paperwork stored within. The residents, they seem friendly and open, and many races intermingle and carry on trade. However, this air of civility is just a facade, as beneath the surface is a brutal world of politics and treachery and betrayal, all presided over by the cunning Arenes named Mizdem Wordtwister. It's a great name. Sitting at the center of a vast web of intrigue, those who violate her laws are killed without question or appeal. But while Mizdem is the public face of authority in the city, the true power of Grenpoli is the pit fiend Lefant, who is the chief administrator of the infernal bureaucracy. In the political school that I mentioned earlier, enterprising devils can learn about treachery and deception. Enries are found in the school in large numbers, since they need their wiles to seduce mortals on the prime material plane. And in general, the politics of the Nine Hells, they have flowers in Grenpoli because this city is the place where the infernal bureaucracy established by Asmodeus carries out its business, and often where the emissaries of the Lords of the Nine and other powers meet up. So it's all kind of centralized here. And the last location that we will talk about before the middle of the show is Ophalion. So how do devils whose memories of human existence were erased before their transformation to Lemur form, how do they remember their experiences well enough to entice souls and subvert societies? Well, they travel to Ophalion, which is a training facility designed to instruct devils on matters of political manipulation and bargaining by creating detailed simulations of locations in the prime material plane. It's essentially, if you're a Star Trek fan, it's like the holodeck. If you're a fan of the X-Men comic books, it's like the Danger Room. It's pretty awesome in a way. So it's a pile of rubble. It's on a blast side, but it's used to simulate population centers so that adventurers whose homelands are undergoing diabolical subversion, they might find like entire chunks of it created here. The city's resident devils have configured its shattered stones to create ruined parodies of palaces, of senatorial chambers, marketplaces, any area where influence is bartered. They run detailed simulations of targeted political activities. So devilish students might take part in a clerical synod or a fake conference of elf princesses, or even the election of a simulated king. Each exercise comes with its own set of rules and victory conditions, and the stakes of such games, even though they're simulations, the stakes are as viciously real for their participants. You know, winners are sent to those target planes to turn their corrupt education into reality, while losers are held back or even demoted. What's cool about this is that moral visitors are occasionally pressed into service as ringers or advisors or disruptive wild cards. Think Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny. But by taking part in such an exercise, these adventurers can then learn what plans Beelzebul's minions have intended or intend to unleash against, you know, their home, their home planet, their home country, what their home plane, whatever it may be. So that's what we have so far. We're going to jump to the middle of the show really quick, do all the midly things, and then we're going to come back and talk about Beelzebul, obviously, the head honcho in charge, is the little crew he's got running around, and also like where he kicks it. Like, where does he stay? Where does he what awful place does he live in? Hello and welcome to the middle of the show. The middle of the show, of course, is where we thank our patrons, discuss any D&D news, as well as meander on over to usually the DM's Guild and figure out what kind of homebrew shenanigans we can get into. So first and foremost, let's thank the patrons. Thank you so much to the patrons who support the show over on patreon.com/dndlorecast. A special shout out to Alex D, our newest patron, who absurdly joined the Discord, immediately started asking for suggestions and advice on a campaign that they're running. The audacity to ask a bunch of D&D nerds to talk about D&D. How dare you, Alex? How dare you? No, just kidding. We love talking about D&D over on the official Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast Discord. There's a link to that in the show notes. If you have any questions, or if you just want to like talk about your like session that you just had, or your character that you're about to run, or characters that you've never even run, characters that you just made up, because that's what D&D nerds do, is just make up characters that will never run. Go right on ahead. We will never stop you. So if you are interested in joining the being a member of the Fair Folk of the Patreon, like I said, you can go over to patreon.com/dndlorecast. We have tiers from $5 to $75 with stickers, t-shirts, mugs, bonus episodes, bonus content, all sorts of cool stuff. Definitely you can get in where you fit in. And if you want to support the show in other ways, you can definitely do so by following us on all the social medias. Pretty much everywhere, we are D&D Lorecast. Instagram, Twitch, we will be in Twitch streaming soon. TikTok, Twitter, and all the subsequent Twitter clones that have popped up in the past several months. We're going to be there. You'll find us, dndlorecast@gmail.com. And of course, the aforementioned D&D Lorecast Discord. Follow us there. You can give us a follow, interact with us there. You can go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us some reviews. And then, of course, just, good old fashioned word of mouth, telling someone that you think might appreciate the show, either at a game store or, on a message board or, whatever it may be, just spreading the news about the community that we're trying to build and trying to foster here, is more than enough. We absolutely appreciate every single bit of support that we receive. Now, as far as D&D news goes, obviously a few months ago, we had Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, the feature-length film released in theaters. Did not do as well financially as we would have hoped, considering it was a very good movie. It was a lot of fun. Really, I felt, was a good introduction to D&D for a lot of non-fans, and for even, for the more well-versed among us. There's still, still a lot of fun. But like I said, the financially just didn't do as well as we were hoping. An executive at Paramount, the company that, that the production company behind the movie, did come out and say that a second movie is not out of the realm of possibility. That's definitely something that they would consider. However, the budget would have to be considerably smaller, considering, how much money the first one made, which obviously, we don't want low budget D&D for sure. However, you don't need a ton, you don't need tens upon, dozens and dozens of millions of dollars to make a great movie, to make a great fantasy movie. So if the original team and both behind the scenes and the original team and doesn't even necessarily have to be a sequel, we're discussing Planescape going into the reintroduction of the campaign setting for fifth edition. There are entire worlds worth of D&D that can be used. We don't necessarily have to stick with the same, five or six characters, movie in and movie out. The next D&D movie can definitely, have a new set of characters and be something different, but still with the D&D branding and still be made on a smaller budget. But yeah, the original team, both behind the camera and in front of the camera, are interested in doing so. I think that's a definite possibility to achieve something great. So hopefully we get the movie. Hopefully it's made within the parameters that make it as successful as possible. And hopefully it still is good or even better than the first one. Let's see, any other news? I don't think so. Something about a video game. Oh, that's right. Baldur's Gate 3 is officially out, and it's kind of taken the internet by storm. People are streaming it. People are talking about it. People are so far, it seems like people are really digging the heck out of Baldur's Gate 3. Looks like the folks over at Larian really knocked it out of the park on this one. It looks incredible. It looks amazing. I have not had the time to sit down and play it. I've been incredibly busy. But as soon as I do, I know that I'm just going to like fall into a rabbit hole and maybe never come back out. But yeah, so Baldur's Gate 3 is out. There's a link to purchase it via Steam if you're interested in the show notes. But yeah, like if you're on the fence as to whether or not you want to buy it, like I said, it's dozens, if not hundreds of people on Twitch are streaming it right now. Twitter's going crazy about it. There are a bunch of, you know, all the D&D Facebook groups that I'm a part of are posting pictures of their characters that they've created. So yeah, people are very excited about it. And then finally, Hellbound Heists, the DM's Guild corner pick of the week that we've been highlighting throughout the Hotter Than the Nine Hells series. Nine layers of hell, nine heists, and the odds aren't in your favor. Explore each layer as a separate adventure or tie them all together for one hellish campaign. It features 29 new monsters, 23 new items, one new background, and innumerable terror. So what does Hellbound Heist have in store for Maledomini? Well, it has a level 14 and up adventure called According to Plan. Help free a rogue from a hellbound prison and aid in the recovery of a valuable set of blueprints. So again, you can buy it on DM's Guild right now. There's a link in the show notes. You can get a digital copy, or you can actually get a physical copy. So if you see something on DM's Guild that is being offered as a physical copy, it means that it's sold a certain amount of items. That means, and if it's sold that many, it means it's probably good, because people usually don't like spending money on subpar content. And so definitely worth your while. Pick it up, Hellbound Heist. And yeah, that's about it. So let's go ahead and jump back into the show. Welcome back to the show. The second half of the show, we'll be talking about the Dukes and other denizens of Maledomini, as well as the Archduke, the ruler of Maledomini, and a little bit of their history as to how they wormed. That's a merry level pun, and you'll understand why once we get into Balzable's history, how they wormed themselves into the realm. So Balzable has a council, and it includes his consorts Baphtis and Lilith, as well as Niabas, who's also known as the Herald of Lies, his Marshal Barbatos, and then he's got three generals, Abigor, Beleth, and Zippar. One of the consorts, Lilith, is a powerful archdevil in her own right. She counsels the Lord of Flies in his plotting so that he, and then therefore she, too, might be once again restored to their former glory. The lair itself is inhabited by numerous intelligent devils, such as Harvester Devils and the aforementioned Arenas, as well as Cornugons, aka the Corndog Devils, Lemures, and others. The constant production of ichor also promotes the spontaneous generation of oozes, such as black puddings, ochre jellies, and of course, everyone's favorite, the gelatinous cube. So, Balzable, Archduke Balzable. What's the deal with Balzable? Okay, so he is a former Archon, you know, think angel essentially, from Mount Celestia, also known as Trill. And now he's known as, you know, one of his nicknames is Trill the Fallen. He rules over this nightmare landscape. And that is a fitting testimony to his own degeneracy. It is his crazed desire for a perfection he can never achieve that drives the endless labor of his subjects. Once Balzable was an Archon of Celestia named Trill, But he was cast down into the nine hells, and Asmodeus quickly promoted Trill to devilhood in a dread ritual. You know, their relentless drive for perfection serves him well as he climbs the ranks of devilry, culminating in Belzebul's ascension to Lord of the Seventh. And Belzebul didn't just attain it, wasn't just given to him this lordship. He deposed the earlier lord and expunged all mention of that entity. So there's no lore as to who, what archdevil ruled the world Maladomini before Belzebul. He literally erased him from history, leaving behind his former name with his former allegiance. Belzebul is also called the Lord of the Flies because not even a fly can escape his net of intrigues. That's awesome. Maladomini was once a bustling realm of vibrant cities, you know, roads, gardens, bridges, all the things that you have in a vibrant city. it was, you know, like I said, it's the center of hell's bureaucracy where every edict, law, and order was dutifully copied and filed away. And with each passing year, the devils would add more fortresses and archives to Maladomini to house all their records. Then came the single greatest act of treachery in the history of the nine hells. Now, when you're poring over the histories of the nine hells and looking over every single act of treachery, I mean, it's a very long list. Devil's gonna devil. So to say that this is the single greatest act of treachery, it's got to be something wild. So let's figure out what happened. So at the time, the archdevil Belzebul was so powerful that he actually ruled two layers of hell, not only Maladomini, but also the sixth layer, Malbolge. He conspired to topple Asmodeus and replace him, which in and of itself is not a crime. I mean, Asmodeus kind of like figures it's going to happen, right? But in order to work his plans, he knowingly altered documents that passed into his care with the intent of confounding the apparatus of the bureaucracy. His attempt to overthrow Asmodeus centered on forging and altering records in an attempt to frame the Lord of the Nine Hells as an incompetent leader. Now, here's the thing. So, like, trying to topple Asmodeus is not a crime in and of itself. It's, you know, whatever. That's the evil in lawful evil, right? However, forging documents is definitely nowhere near lawful. So it's kind of like how they got Al Capone for tax evasion. So before his scheme could come to fruition, he was caught and subjected to the most bizarre of punishments. So how exactly did Belzebul get caught? So in that time long past, Belzebul believed that he could cast Asmodeus as incompetent, as an incompetent leader, ruler of the Nine Hells, and amass a force to replace him before Asmodeus' allies could act. But Belzebul's calculations failed to take into account the unpredictability of the Blood War, which we will be talking about next week. So excited. So a sudden offensive from the Abyss struck Avernus just as Belzebul was about to put his plan into motion. Belzebul directed most of his shield legions to stay out of the fight. You know, he's like, hey, we got something else going on. So instead of helping to hold the line against the demons, he could use them to, you know, help stage his own coup. The absence of those legions, the absence of the, you know, the Maladomian forces, however, enabled the demonic horde to push deep to the doorstep of Dis. So as, you know, once this happens, once they're, you know, really like knocking on the door of Dis, Belzebul is forced to abandon his own plans for the coup, realizing that the Nine Hells would be of little use to him if it was overrun with demons. And ultimately, he united with the other archdevils to, you know, fight back the demonic horde, the demonic invasion. But, you know, obviously everyone's trying to figure out, like, how did this happen? Like, how did they get this far? And so there was an investigation, and the investigation of the events uncovered his treachery. Regardless, Belzebul refused to submit to punishment. And so Maladomini was racked with fighting as the other lords of the Nine Hells took to the field against the conspirator. So essentially, like, they're like, hey, like, your treachery, like, nearly screwed us. Here's your punishment. He's like, I'm not going to do that. And so then the other lords of the Nine were like, all right, we're just going to, like, you wreck your place. The resulting devastation left much of the lair in ruins, And obviously, like, you know, Basil refused to submit to the punishment of the Lords of the Nine, can't really refuse to submit to the punishment of Asmodeus. Asmodeus transforms Basil's formerly angelic body into a melted slug-like form, hence the worm pun that I made earlier that I'm not proud of. I'm not proud of it, but just to, you know, agree that it happened, accept it, and move on. After Beelzebul was overwhelmed and defeated, Asmodeus stripped him of his rulership of Malbolge, but left him in charge of Maledomini, albeit with like a new set of duties. So Asmodeus knew that Beelzebul's superior intellect and propensity for lying, the way he's like he's smart, but he's a little liar, would make him the ideal representative of the bureaucracy of the Hells in the worlds of the mortals. So to ensure his loyalty, while also taking advantage of his talents, Asmodeus enacted two laws concerning him. And Asmodeus, and you know, we've talked in depth about Asmodeus, you know, specifically and throughout the Hotter Than the Nine Hells series, you know, in general, Asmodeus is one of the most clever creatures in all of, you know, all of D&D. Will always figure out a way to make a situation benefit him the most. So what are these two laws? So the first, whenever Beelzebul lies to a devil, he would transform into a slug-like creature, hideous to all who beheld him for 1 year. Now you might be thinking, well, he's already a slug-like creature, so like, what, how does that work? Well, it's because the penalty was retroactive, covering several millennia of deceptions and untruths. So he was turned into a slug because he's like, all right, well, every time you lie to a devil, you're going to turn to a slug for a year. And that includes all the lies that you already told. And so only recently has Beelzebul worked off all those transgressions and has been returned to his former humanoid form. And in all that time, he has not told a lie to another devil, and his continued honesty is motivated by his desire to keep his current appearance, like his original appearance of, you know, like kind of a fallen angel and not a weird slug-like worm thing. So the second rule that Asmodeus enacted is he decreed that any deal Beelzebul strikes shall end in disaster for the other party. And so for this reason, other devils avoid forming alliances with him, even though they know he is compelled, or not compelled, but, you know, it's in his best interest not to lie to them. They're like, well, he's probably telling us the truth because he doesn't want to turn into a slug for a year. But, you know, we also, it's going to end in disaster for us, so we're just not even going to bother. Mortals, on the other hand, know nothing of the situation and so still offer their souls to him. So his, you know, his focus is most of his attention on gathering souls from the material plane, you know, a task to which his talent and, you know, kind of like the situation he's in is best suited. His talent for lying and in the current situation he's in, it's best suited for that. You know, his ability to scheme has been neutralized by these limitations in some way, but he continues to ensure that the devil's bureaucracy runs smoothly. Also, Beelzebul and his agents recruit mortals that are desperate for redemption of some sort, perhaps the restoration of lost status or the recovery of resources that were lost because of either treachery or incompetence. To these people who have been humbled by unfortunate events, Beelzebul offers a supernatural means of regaining one's reputation or riches. You know, the failed merchant desperate for another chance at making his fortune, or the once treacherous knight eager to restore her honor. You know, these are typical examples of the individuals he deals with. But what these folks don't know is that Beelzebul is a master manipulator. He directs his agents to embed clauses and specifications in contracts that trip up the unwary. Devil's in the details, after all. And because Beelzebul's targets are typically desperate, he almost always bargains from a position of strength. And although Beelzebul claims a great number of unsuspecting souls. Almost all of them are pathetic, incompetent wretches best suited for the Dreg Legions, whose only task is to die as slowly as possible so that they might delay the advance of a demonic abyssal army. Nowadays, Beelzebul only openly plots against Mephistopheles, Lord of the Eighth, but his undying anger yet burns for Asmodeus, as does his undying ambition for the throne of the King of the Nine Hells. So, where does Beelzebul kick it? Where does he chill? Where does he stay? Well, he stays in Malagard. It's home to Beelzebul and the greatest city in the lair of Maledomini. So the city de jure of Trail of the Fallen, everyone pretty much agrees that it's the greatest city that they've ever constructed, that the devil's working nonstop over and over in Maledomini that they've ever constructed. Nor does anyone doubt that it will be shortly abandoned by the crazed Archduke as Beelzebul strives for some strange hellish perfection in all things. But while he is in residence, work continues. In fact, it says one source said that the workers have begun to slow down in the final stages, sabotaging much of their own work as to not have to, like, you know, restart again. Because as soon as they're done, they're like, we're going to have to just do this again. So we might as well just kind of like keep doing what we're doing. I guess it's easier to like, it's easier to start, you know, the final stages is easier than having to like start all over again. Just continue the final stages, rather. Beelzebul hasn't seemed to notice yet, but it's only a matter of time before he demands completion of the project. So, Malagard was once a beautiful city of perfectly straight boulevards, fountains of delicate yet terrible visage, and towers that reach straight as an arrow into the blood-black sky. However, more recent lore depicts the city as the embodiment of Beelzebul's physical worm-like, slug-like sloth, and describes Malagard as crumbling into ruin. Now, this is a result, a direct result of his treachery that he was punished for. Armies of damned souls and lesser devils labor to raise new buildings or repair streets slumping into sludge. But their efforts seem pointless. The decay simply advances. A miasma of fatalism pervades the city, and visitors often fall into a gray despair and never muster the willpower to leave Malagard. While here, Beelzebul rules from the Palace of Filth, a vast structure constantly filled with refuse by lesser devils in obedience to the punishment decreed by Asmodeus. After Beelzebul's treachery, the Grand Castle collapsed into a pile of fecal sludge, and now the Lord of the Flies shapes and reshapes its interior himself, hollowing out rooms and corridors by crawling through the massive pile of waste. Amid these heaps of debris are the ruins of several thoroughly crushed ancient buildings, and in lieu of doorways, there are magical barriers that bar entrance to unwanted guests. Beelzebul must periodically reinforce his rooms with slime secretions, or at least had to when he was still in slug form, because when he forgets to do so, entire rooms collapse, smothering many of his lesser minions. He often neglects these maintenance duties, you know, obviously, because it kind of bums him out. Like, I mean, it's a reminder of everything that he has lost. So he instead doesn't do that in favor of scheming for future dominance. So entire rooms collapsing, smothering many of his lesser minions, something that happens more often than not. His treasure vaults have fallen down so often, in fact, that several great relics of power are now lost among the trash and debris. It seems like a hoarder situation that Beelzebul's got going on. Like, you know, you don't know what you might find there. Some you know, ancient relic of power. But even so, you know, fortune seekers can't really root through these collapsed chambers undisturbed, as the muck that makes up the palace walls and floors, it squelches it, you know, so horribly that whenever it's moved, it inevitably attracts the attention of palace guards. So there you have it, Maledomini, Beelzebul, the treachery behind why this fallen angel was a slug for several millennia. It's a lot of fun. There's so much fantastic lore attached to the Nine Hells, and it's been so fun, you know, digging into all of it. And it's kind of sad that we're just about done. We've only got one left. But thank you so much for listening. I know Mary misses you, and I know you miss Mary. We will be back next week to talk the Blood War. So make sure that you follow us on the social medias, talk with us on our Discord. But until then, fare thee well, dear listener, and may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at D&D Lorecast, or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.com.